Okay, so I'll just get started here. Today I thought I would talk about, I guess loosely, what it means to be a Buddhist. And I've talked about this topic before in another way, but today I'd like to be a little more broad than I normally would, and simply talk about the different ways that we approach Buddhism, the different ways that different people approach Buddhism in different ways. And an important point is that there really is no wrong way to approach the Buddha's teaching. And there is no one single way of understanding the Buddha's teaching. In fact, according to the Buddha's teaching, as I understand it, the word wrong way or wrong path really only has meaning in a conventional sense. That really all paths, all ways have are not intrinsically good or bad. They are good or bad based on the results that they bring. So there's really no there's nothing wrong with picking this or that path, whether it be a Buddhist path, an approach to Buddhism or not, simply a way of living one's life, as long as you're prepared for the results. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with all of the evil deeds that the Buddha said were evil, except the reason they're given this name evil is that they have a bad result. They have a result that is undesired. That if a person really understood what they were getting themselves into, if they truly had understanding and wisdom, they wouldn't do those things. They wouldn't engage in that way because it's contrary to their interest. It doesn't lead to their happiness. It doesn't lead to their peace. It doesn't lead to freedom from suffering. So I think this is the best way to approach the Buddha's teaching, that you're welcome to interpret the Buddha's teaching in any way you want. You're welcome to look at it in any way and use it for anything that you so choose, as long as you're prepared to accept the consequences. And as long as you understand that you understand the results of your mode of behavior, your path, your way of life, for what it is, that you don't have some unrealistic expectations from your practice, from your mode of behavior. So, and there are different results, quite very different results that come from the different ways that we approach Buddhism. And this is how we should understand these different ways. It's important not to take, as I said in in a talk a couple of days ago, not to take I think it's defined as a postmodernist point of view, that something is good simply because I think it's good, simply because I follow it or I believe in it, or it's simply because it's my way. It has to be a path has to be judged on its merits. It can't be judged from a subjective point of view. It should be judged objectively. So simply saying that I believe this, I believe that, or this is my way, this is that is my way, isn't good enough. It isn't an excuse to practice in that way. Simply saying that it's my way or my belief doesn't make it right. This is something we should understand, and something that has, I think, been lost in many circles in modern times. So I just want to talk a little bit about how people approach Buddhism and what I think are some of the results, I guess, of those ways. The first way that people often will approach Buddhism is on an intellectual level, but merely as a part of a broader whole. So people who are interested in Buddhism, and these are the people who like to pick and choose, people who have their own way or are trying to find their own way. And in general, people who have a great attachment to individualism, they're finding their own way, where they wouldn't want to follow after a teacher or a specific way. And so they take part. They take something from Buddhism. They pick and choose the things that agree with their way, or the things that they can for themselves see to be valuable, they take and incorporate into their own understanding of the universe. They would never call themselves Buddhists. And this is to be encouraged in a sense. It's at the very least, it's something good for those people. It's something that we should feel as Buddhists, as people who spread the Buddhist teaching, should feel happy about, that people are taking the good things that Buddhism has to offer. We should never feel jealous or stingy with what is good about Buddhism or what is good about our practice. If people don't take all that we have to offer, then it's like we offer a full meal and they just take the pickles or something. They just take the condiments. Well, we can at least feel happy that they've taken the condiments. They've taken something and they've gotten something good. The problem, of course, with this sort of approach, I think the biggest problem with it is the egoism involved. In most cases, because I can imagine certain people who are so far advanced that they are able to find their own way, but I doubt that I'm going to meet such a person in my life. I never have, and I doubt that I will. I may, but judging by the nature of this world at this time, it seems to me highly unlikely that such a being will be found. They may exist, but I think we're talking on a scale of magnitude of 1 in a billion or more. 1 in a trillion, maybe, beings. Most people who take this sort of approach where they want to find their own path have overestimated themselves. And we find this in Buddhism as well. There are people who have accepted the Buddhist teaching, who call themselves Buddhists, but are reluctant to practice under a teacher. They have this idea that they can go off on their own and become enlightened. And quite often they fail through lack of instruction, through lack of guidance, because it's much easier to see someone else's faults than to see one's own. But here we're on another scale of magnitude, talking about those people who don't have a religion, don't have a path, or who are trying to find their own way, consider themselves spiritual beings, and take some pieces from the Buddha's teaching, maybe from other paths as well, and sort of pick and choose. And in a sense, it's reinventing the wheel, because what you're saying is that for you, none of the paths that exist are sufficient. And so it's more desirable for you to find your own way. And this is kind of it's understandable, because I think many of the paths that exist out there, whether they be religious or secular, are insufficient and have insufficient information, insufficient background, and are unreasonable in the sense that if someone were to examine thoroughly that path and to use their intellect, to use their reason, they wouldn't be able to accept that path. But I don't believe that such is the case with Buddhism. It's my understanding that the Buddhist teaching is perfectly rational, perfectly reasonable, and does lead those who practice it to full peace, happiness, true peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. But irregardless of whether that's true or not, I think in this case of picking and choosing, people often don't make a thorough enough study. They've examined one or two or several of the various religious traditions, some of them in depth, some of them not in depth, and they've come to a general belief that this is the case, that there is no path for them, that it's up to them to find their own path. It might often be based on their misunderstandings of in this case, the Buddhist teaching. It might be based on their misunderstandings of what is true peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. But I think it often simply comes from laziness, or it comes, as I said, from egoism, from this desire to find one's own way or to somehow be special. I mean, I think we all have this innate desire to feel special, to feel different, to somehow be the hero. No, we're given this hero complex, where we want to be the hero or the heroine, the protagonist of the story. And so, to follow another teacher would be to reduce ourselves. As in the Buddhist time, one teacher said, can't remember what it actually was. It was something like a big drum into a small kettle, or something, to for some something very big and meaningful to reduce itself to a student, to something unmeaningful, to just be a student. But as I said, I think it's nice to see that people take things, and I think the point here is that we should never feel stingy. And if people, even people from other religions, want to take meditation and practice it in their religion, I think, first of all, simply from a point of view of generosity, we should give it to them. We should be willing to teach people that which is beneficial. We should never, as the Buddha said, wish for them to become followers of ours. We should not be looking for students. But we know that the teaching that we have is something beneficial, so insofar as people will take it, we give it. And by giving, we do a good deed. And also, I think it's something that spreads Buddhism. It's something that allows people to see the open nature of the Buddha's teaching, that it's not dogma. that it's not a cult, that we're not simply looking for other subscribers who will then support or support our own belief. Because this is what you often find in other religious traditions. It's something you find often in Buddhism among those who are still, you could say, spiritually immature. This desire to convert others, and rather forcefully, in fact, in many cases. It's something that comes from a lack of true conviction, of true understanding, of true belief, true confidence that is based on understanding. Because when you are working on belief, you're working on shaky ground. It's something that is constantly being tested. No, there's doubts constantly arising. So, in order to augment your belief or to keep your faith strong, you convert all the people around you. And when other people believe the same thing that you do, that reinforces your belief. And so you see this in many religious traditions, this desire to convert, because it then reinforces one's own belief. And if you don't convert others, then you might find yourself slipping away from the belief yourself. But in Buddhism, this isn't the case. In Buddhism, we're dealing with the truth, we're dealing with understanding. So there is no need to try to convert people to Buddhists, and there is no benefit. And this is part of what I'm trying to explain today, is that there are many different ways to approach the Buddha's teaching. The importance is the benefit that you gain. Another related means of approaching Buddhism is from those people who do call themselves Buddhists but fail to practice the Buddha's teaching. I think, actually, thinking about it, this group is inferior to those people who don't call themselves Buddhists but do practice at least some of the teachings. Because there are many people in this world who call themselves Buddhists and yet don't seem to be practicing the teachings. They might be insincere, fraudulent. They might just be lazy and negligent, not keeping any of the moral precepts, not practicing meditation, not being generous, so on. They might be proud and arrogant, holding themselves up, or they might even be teachers. There are many teachers who are able to teach the Buddha's teaching and yet don't practice it themselves. There are even reported cases of monks in the past, in the various ages, who have not practiced the Buddha's teaching in any appreciable manner, and in fact engaged in trickery and treachery, in debauchery and immorality in general. These sorts of people exist, and I think all of it, there's not much to say here, because I think anyone who has any basic understanding of the Buddhist teaching knows that there's no benefit to be had here. This isn't one of those religions that is on a subscription basis. You're in or you're out. There's none of that. Just being in has no, being subscribed has no meaning. If you're not practicing, you can call yourself an arahant, you can call yourself a Buddha, and it has no meaning. But it's something that we have to understand, that because it can lead to complacency. Calling yourself a Buddhist, calling yourself a teacher, calling yourself a monk. Calling yourself a Sotapanna, a Sakitagami, an arahant, an enlightened being. There are people on the internet who claim to be enlightened beings, and I'm not going to say anything about that, but I have my own ideas on that sort of thing. I personally couldn't imagine if supposing I attained some state of enlightenment to broadcast it. I can't imagine broadcasting a state of enlightenment on a public scale. But there is rationalization. People believe that it's useful. But supposing that there are certain people who do broadcast it and are either misled or misleading others, this sort of person is obviously doing great demerit. This is probably the worst way of approaching the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha called it, such a person, a thief. Because Buddhism has a great reputation in the world. It's something that is very difficult to denounce, to refute. Mostly people who don't like it are just quiet and try to avoid the subject. It's something that has a good reputation. It's something that is well known to bring good results, verifiable results, scientifically, laboratory, clinically verifiable results. And so, if you set yourself up as a Buddhist teacher, or even as a Buddhist, you somehow get a good reputation. There are many people who become monks, and as a result of that, gain great luxury and can gain great material benefit. And so the Buddha called these sorts of people thieves. The sort of person who takes this material benefit and does nothing of any good, or is fraudulent, is not really deserving of it. A person who pretends to be a monk, for instance, or pretends to be a Buddhist. But I think more common is the sort of person who calls themselves Buddhist but doesn't practice. And I think that we should really understand this label of Buddhist. Calling yourself Buddhist should not be seen as any beneficial thing of any sort. That calling oneself Buddhist, the identification as a Buddhist is not of any benefit whatsoever, and we should cease to see it as a beneficial thing. It can sometimes be useful. We should see it as a utilitarian or something that is practical, so that people will know the sort of practices that you're engaged in. Something that you can use to identify yourself, just as your name is a practical thing. Your name has no intrinsic benefit. You can't say that your name makes you a good person. My name is Noah, so therefore I'm a spiritual holy person who saves animals or so on. You can't say that, but your name has a use for it. It's something that allows you to be known to people. It can have detriment if people come to know that that this person is, they know you in a bad way, or they've heard bad things about you. But it's a useful thing. Calling yourself Buddhist can be useful in that sense, in terms of allowing people to understand the sorts of things you can practice. In the West, I think probably many people here have realized it can also be a detriment. You know, telling your family you're Buddhist, telling a Christian family that you're Buddhist, and so on. Telling a Jewish family that you're Buddhist. Very difficult. But often we come to be complacent. Monks become even more complacent, because a monk is the perfect life for practicing, for becoming enlightened. So we come to mistake that label or that title for the actual practice that it allows. This is quite dangerous. Being a Buddhist by label, being a Buddhist on your identity card, or calling yourself Buddhist, calling yourself a Lama or a Guru or a Rinpoche or a Bante or a monk, whatever you call yourself, this can be very dangerous, and we should always ask ourselves, what is it for, and use it only when it's appropriate. For instance, there's one in Thailand that has come up. In Thailand there's several that have come up. One of the big ones is the word Ajahn. And in Thailand it's kind of funny, and there is some use to it, because monks will call each other Ajahn. And it's really a cultural sort of thing. It's a way of being really polite. You call everybody Ajahn. You call everybody teacher. The monks call each other teacher. And it's a way of kind of smoothing the ice, or breaking the ice, smoothing things over, making people feel comfortable and not hurting other people's feelings. Dealing with ordinary people, monks who might not be practicing, you call them Ajahn and they feel good about themselves. They feel, yeah, I'm a teacher. But you see, it builds up this ego. And it's something that I think has been transplanted, or it's been taken by Western monks in the Ajahn Chah tradition, this well-known Thai tradition of monks. And so they call themselves Ajahn. They write books and put the word Ajahn on their books, and when people ask, yeah, my name is Ajahn so and so. And I mean, I don't really want to say the right or the wrong about it, its place in Thailand, but I think it's dangerous and it's misleading. It's somehow propping oneself up, because I would only call myself Ajahn if I was talking to my students. Someone who had undertaken to practice meditation and had recognized me as one of their teachers. I wouldn't come up to a perfect stranger and say, my name is Ajahn so-and-so. I'm not your teacher. I'm a monk. My status as a teacher has no importance in that context. I'm trying to tell you who I am. That's one example. This I think a misuse of the word, or overuse of the word Ajahn in Thailand. But we see it all over. People come to call themselves Rinpoche, or call themselves this teacher, that teacher, and it's useful to let people know that you have some sort of qualification or so on. But the point is not to let it become a hindrance for your own practice, where it makes you complacent, where you think that you've somehow become something, or you've attained something thereby. I know many monks who are really down to earth about this, and there was one Israeli monk who was really he was a funny monk in many ways, but he said he refused to call himself a teacher, and he taught all the time. He taught meditation courses. People came to see him, and he taught them meditation. But he said, "I'm not a teacher. I refuse to call myself a teacher." He said, I something like, "I'm a guide or something. I'm here to guide you." And I follow that sort of line of thought myself. I think that's something that I would recommend, in a sense. I mean, I wouldn't even call myself a guide. I would say, you know, at the time when you're teaching, you're a teacher. But to establish yourself as a teacher, I am a teacher, I think is to misplace your proper identity. We're all students. We're all learning. And we are all beings. I think the most important is to see yourself for what you are, to see yourself for being the physical and the mental, to see yourself as being a flux of experiences arising and ceasing. And so to get a sense of yourself as a being, yourself as this complex entity, aggregation of experience. It's lost when you start to put labels on it, when you call yourself Buddhist, when you call yourself teacher, when you call yourself this or that or the other thing, whatever you call yourself. So calling yourself Buddhist, this is easy to see the danger it has. There are, I think, millions of Buddhists out there, people who call themselves Buddhist, but I guarantee that most of them are not practicing Buddhism in any appreciable form. And there's often a very strong tradition of ritual surrounding cultural Buddhists. And those rituals or certain practices that have become ritualistic might have benefit. But there might be some benefit in those due to the intentions at the time, because there's a basic understanding of intention. And the Buddha said ritual is of no benefit whatsoever. The ritual itself is of no benefit. But it's important to look at the qualities of the mind that are gained from that ritual. I mean, there are many Buddhist ceremonies that lead only to immorality, unwholesomeness. You know, Buddhist funerals in Thailand. People come drunk to Buddhist funerals. People drink at Buddhist funerals. Here in Sri Lanka, they have great paying homage to the relics, homage to puja, they call them puja. If you know, in India they have big pujas as well, but here in Sri Lanka they also have big pujas. And I got in a little bit of an argument. They wanted me to do some translating for this parade, parahara, I think is what they call it. They said, "What's a parahara?" They said, and I said, "Parade." And they said, yes, that's it, parade." I said, what does that have to do with me? They said, "Oh, well, we want you to do the translating." I said, it's not really Buddhist now, is it?" And they said, "Oh, no, it's a puja. It's a very complex way of paying respect to the Buddha. But it's a little bit hypocritical, I think, because it's contrary to the things that the Buddha taught, namely that sensuality is low, is inferior, it's something that leads to clinging and craving and clinging and suffering. Something that the Buddha taught was no good. So we're promoting those things, you know, sensual indulgence, which is something that the Buddha taught against. And so there's nothing wrong per se with these rituals, and this is how people get away with it. They have all these complex explanations of why and how this is somehow beneficial. You know, even how they can justify having beauty pageants in the monastery, which is something that got me in a lot of trouble as well. But the proof is in the pudding, and you can reason until you're blue in the face, but if in the end it's something that leads people to give rise to craving, give rise to attachment, then it's no good. And if it's likely to do that, it's something that you shouldn't engage in. But that being said, there are many simple, beautiful rituals in Buddhist countries that do have benefit, and these are often misunderstood by foreigners, by non-Buddhists. We look at traditional Buddhists as being ridiculous and misunderstanding the Buddhist teaching, and we dismiss these rituals. People dismiss making offerings to the Buddha image, making offerings to a stupa, a chaitya. They misinterpret going on pilgrimages to the Buddhist places in India. And so they denigrate such activity, when the Buddha himself said that such pilgrimages would be of great benefit, offering to the chaitya of a Buddha, the stupa of the Buddha, would be of great benefit. Offering to the Bodhi tree would be of great benefit. So I was asked recently, why is this? And the point, of course, as I said, is the intentions. when your intention is to pay homage, pay respect to an enlightened being, there's a great benefit that comes therefrom. The great benefit is to your own mind. You're aligning yourself with that person as your teacher, as your leader, as your guide, and with their teachings. I can say from personal experience, going to India to see the Buddhist holy place is a wonderful experience. It's profound. It's life-changing. I suppose it's maybe only that way if you know the meaning of the places in advance, and if you know something about Buddhism. But it really enhances your practice. It's something that really makes it real for you. Going to see where the Buddha lived, and going to pay respect to the places where the Buddha's influence still exists, where you can still feel the power of the Buddha's teaching, of the Buddha's influence. So, you know, often these rituals go to extreme, and they can be. It can be above and beyond what is necessary, what is beneficial. But ritual has, I was told once, I think it's Carlos Castaneda who said that ritual has the power to capture people's attention. And I think that's an apt explanation of what ritual does. Ritual can be very useful, and I hear in the Tibetan tradition they're quite fond of ritual. I know in pretty much all traditions of Buddhism there's a long tradition of ritual activity. And the point is it's a method. It's an established method of doing good deeds. There are established methods of vowing to take morality, to take moral precepts. There's established ways of giving gifts to monks or to the Buddha. And these methods allow us to put aside the particulars, to put aside these details of how and who and what and when and where, and focus on what's important, and that is the giving or the taking of the precepts or so on. The act of goodness. So that we can focus on that and not have to worry about the particulars. So in this sense, I would say traditional Buddhists are gaining some benefit. People who live in a Buddhist society and take part in Buddhist rituals, at the very least, are supportive of those people who are practicing. And thus gain a great benefit for themselves. They feel happy, they feel content. They get a great, at least mundane benefit from supporting the Buddha's teaching. Buddhism wouldn't have survived if it weren't for people who didn't understand and didn't practice, but appreciated and believed in, suppose you could say, but the point here is not the belief, the point is the appreciation, having some kind of liking towards or good feeling towards the Buddha's teaching based on perhaps the practice of Buddhists that they've met, the practice of monks. When monks go on alms round, many people are able to see how pure they are, how calm and serene they are, how focused they are, how disciplined they are. And as a result, come to feel a great affection towards the monks and towards Buddhism. And because it's something that is so pure and so rational and so scientific and so beneficial, they are right to have such confidence, to have such affection towards it. And it's something that can really bring great true and lasting benefit to such people. And so I wouldn't I wouldn't underestimate the benefit of this sort of thing, the benefit of people's faith that they have in Buddhism, because the other thing is that such people are building up a great base for the practice of Buddhism. One thing that teachers, both Western and Eastern teachers of Buddhism, have come to remark upon is how unprepared Western people or non-Buddhists in general are when it comes to practicing meditation. You can't, it's not something you can just jump into. You can try, but it's very difficult. Because if your life is based on another set of principles, to come and take on a new set of principles is like trying to make a U-turn. The inertia is incredible. Whereas those people who have structured their life around the Buddha's teaching without really practicing it in any meaningful way, perhaps breaking all the precepts and being generally immoral and uninterested, but in some way appreciative and supportive of other people who are actually practicing, that this prepares them. And if and when they do decide to practice, it's much easier for them because it's something familiar. So this is another way that people approach the Buddhist teaching. But I think, as should be clear to all of us here, I can't imagine, or for those people anyway who have had some at least basic instruction and study on what is the Buddhist teaching, what is Buddhism, we understand that it's in the practice. And it's in a specific type of practice, and that is the practice to understand, to see clearly, to see things as they are. This word enlightenment, coming to understand the truth of reality, which is the things that the Buddha taught. There's no separation between what the Buddha taught and the truth of reality. This is the claim a Buddhist practitioner makes. This is the claim that the Buddha made. That the word Dhamma, the Buddha used interchangeably to mean reality and to mean his teaching. Because he didn't put any kind of trademark on the teaching. He didn't say, this is my teaching. This is something special to me. He said that all Buddhas, all enlightened beings teach these things, teach in the same way. All Buddhas will teach people to see things as they are, will teach people to see reality, will not give any dogma or belief, but will teach people to see what is already there for what it is, and to give up their illusions and their delusions. So when we say that the best way to be Buddhist is to practice the Buddha's teaching, we say the true and the most lofty and high way to approach the Buddha's teaching is to practice his teachings. We're not really saying anything new. This is understood in all religious traditions, that the practice of the teachings is the way of being such and such a person or a belonger to a member of that religious tradition. But in this case, there's something special, and that is that we simply mean the understanding of reality. So we don't have to say that the best way to be a Buddhist is to follow the Buddha's teaching. We can cut to the chase and say the best way to be a Buddhist is to practice to understand things as they are. To the extent that we can come to see reality for what it is, so to that extent will we be considered good Buddhists, or will we be considered to be approaching the Buddha's teaching in the best way. Because this is where we gain the most benefit from it. The benefit of the Buddha's teaching is that it's true, is that it's real, is that it's a description of reality for what it is. And the benefit of seeing reality for what it is supreme, is unexcelled, is unsurpassed. Because all of our suffering, all of our misery, all of our dissatisfaction is derived from our delusions, our misunderstandings, our inability to have a one-to-one relationship with reality where it is what it is. Instead, we have a one-to-a-million relationship where it is it, whatever the experience that we have, is a million different things. We experience one thing and we make any number of things out of it. It's good, it's me, it's mine. It must be changed, it must be kept. All of the judgments and the labels and the identifications that we place on our experience. This is called misunderstanding. This is the the misunderstanding of reality, not taking reality for what it is, not seeing reality for what it is. It's seeing reality for something other than what it is. And so all of the Buddha's teaching is simply in the end to allow us to see reality for what it is, and thereby to be free from all suffering. It's very simple. The problem is that our delusions are very complicated. Our misunderstandings are very complex. Our identities. To even just to hear that who you are is an illusion, is a falsehood, is a concept, is something very scary to most people, let alone being told that you're to let it go, or to somehow take up a path of letting it go, of giving up. So in Buddhism, this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand reality for what it is. We are looking at the experiences, looking at who we are and our relationship with the world around us at every moment, and trying to separate the illusion from reality. And this is, it's a very simple theory, it's a very simple concept, but this is the point, is that our illusions are so complex. And so just to dig down to the ultimate reality is an incredible task. And this is the task that's set in front of us. This is what meditation is for. The practice of meditation, the word meditation is a wonderful word. It applies perfectly to Buddhism. It's the consideration, the examining, the measuring of the experience to try and get at its core, to see it simply for what it is. And so this is why we teach meditation based on watching the physical, watching the mental, watching the emotions, watching the sensations that arise. Because by looking, by examining, by breaking apart experience, we come to see that there is a very definite reality in our experience, and the rest is all falsehood. We come to see that we have many knots inside, we've tied ourselves up, and we have many tangles, and these are what give rise to all of our neurotic, obsessive, compulsive behaviors, all of our stresses and worries and sufferings, all of our angers and fears and so on. Any practice that we can undertake to see reality for what it is, this is really the best thing that we can get out of Buddhism. Because this is really what Buddhism means. The word Buddha means one who knows. It's not one who believes or one who acts in a certain way. Buddha has to do with knowing. It's the knowing that is the most important. And in this sense, it means knowing reality, knowing all, knowing the universe, understanding things as they are. This is why we teach meditation. This is why we teach meditation the way we teach. We don't teach meditation to see things outside of ourselves or to go to another realm or so on. We teach meditation to see reality for what it is, and to understand things as they are. So I'm going to stop there. I think there is some audio problem, but I think sometimes I'm pausing and sometimes you've lost me. But the whole of the talk will be up on my website in maybe half an hour. So thank you all for coming, and I hope this has been of some benefit and that you're able to put this into practice and able to take this as a framework for how you should see your own practice, and that we should understand that the most important thing is our actual practice. And I hope that you're all able to put the Buddha's teaching into practice and that you're able to come to see things as they are, for your own peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. Thank you all for tuning in, and have a good day.